You are locked on Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I'm Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. As I kind of alluded to on yesterday's show, I still had more good Reddit questions that I wanted to answer, and there were some that I felt guilty, actually, that I answered part of it and not the other part of it. So I wanted to go through all of that in this episode, and this will be on the shorter end because then I will have another episode on Friday night / Saturday morning about the Kings game, which will occur on Friday night. So the first thing I wanted to do was Carnivorous Shrimp had a question about big men and who they face, and the guy I forgot to mention was Derek Favors. So Derek Favors might play mostly power forward for the Jazz, but he also might play backup center, especially if he's in a more limited place. He's still not playing, as the last time I heard, and he creates real problems for the Warriors because he's athletic enough that you wouldn't necessarily want to use the slower, you know, like the Zaza Pachulias of the world, but also I'm not sure that he's really playing JaVale puts too much of an advantage there. So I would basically try out everybody and just see who works. Favors is a special talent. There's a reason why when he's healthy, he's not a backup, he's a starter. But I wanted to mention him as well, just to kind of give a fuller picture of it. And then I also forgot the second part of Hellacase21's question, which was toaster, yay or nay, and referring to Klay Thompson signing a fan's toaster. And as somebody who has a paper plate signed by former Niners player Jimmy Johnson, not the same as the coach who's on, I think he's still on Fox, I fully support asking players to sign weird things, and it's great if they do. I mean, especially if it's something that you think you're going to keep for a while, because then it's not just like a place filler in that sort of way. So, hey, you want to do it in that direction, they're willing to sign it, by all means. I am completely, completely on board. Question from Swegen, S-W-E-G-N. This is an interesting one. What would Steph Curry need to do to be recognized as a top 10 all-time player? Assuming he manages to stay relatively injury-free, or for what further duration of time, what does he need to do? There are kind of a couple different ways to think about top 10 players, because some people focus more on the overall career, and in that case, he's going to need to play for a long time, and he's going to need to play at a high level, because you have a lot of amazing players that have had careers in the NBA. And for reference, the ESPN all-time NBA rank, I looked it up, the number 10 player there was Hakeem Olajuwon the last time they did it. And Hakeem is an unbelievable player. I mean, one of the best centers of all time. So if you're looking more in the best career argument, it's going to take Curry a really long time, because Olajuwon was great for a while. And the guys above him, you know, if you're talking about Kareem and everybody else, a lot of them have longevity, Tim Duncan. And also, Curry's probably going to have to be at least the second best player of this kind of generation, because anybody else who is ahead of him, then they start pushing the standard even higher. So LeBron is 1A, like not even 1A, LeBron is 1. And whoever else he needs to pass, make sure he's ahead of Durant and everybody else, maybe even Chris Paul, because Chris Paul has had an amazing career. The other way of looking at it is by focusing more on peak. You have to look at the whole thing, no matter what, but focusing more on peak. And there, it's probably a little bit different of a standard, because Curry's peak so far was incredibly high, because that year, the 2015-16 season, where he was unanimous MVP, is one of the best offensive years in NBA history. And yeah, his defense wasn't great, but you know, I think that you can use that as a stepping stone into getting into some of these bigger discussions. But even if you are peak focused, which I actually am, I think when you're saying the best player of all time, I focus more on how actually good they were, not on how long they played. But you need enough to say that that year was not an aberration. And the problem for Curry is that he was so much better in 15-16 than he even was in 14-15 when he won the MVP over James Harden, that I think he needs at least one more season at that level minimum to really get into that conversation, and probably at least two. And right now he's not even close to that. Right now he's closer to the year before, the last Mark Jackson year, which was a great year, but not nearly the same level of overall performance. So there isn't a real hard and fast answer, but if you want to think about Hakeem Olajuwon as the line in the sand, then you're looking at a really amazing career. And Curry is young enough that it certainly can happen. And in terms of the way other people discuss this, winning a bunch of championships can certainly help. So if he is the point guard and wins, let's say, at least one finals MVP on a couple more NBA championships, then you start to make that argument. And I think it's something that has hurt John Stockton a lot, and it can help other guys. And so it's another part of this equation, but it is really interesting. And a question from K-S-T-I-V-E-S. I don't think there's a way to pronounce that, so I'll say it. Do you think Patrick McCaw can contribute valuable minutes in the playoffs? He seems to be developing nicely for a rookie. I agree with the second part. He is developing nicely for a rookie. He has gotten he has a nice sense of where he needs to be playing with better players, and that is very encouraging in terms of his potential role moving forward. Let's say Andre Iguodala leaves. While he doesn't perfectly fit in that spot, his ability to mesh with great players, and the Warriors certainly have great players, is a major help. And so they could run some different things out there. They're still going to be looking for lots of talent, but he can fit in there. In terms of valuable minutes in the playoffs, the simple answer is they're not going to have that many left to distribute once we get into the minutes of real value, because the top guys are going to get minutes. That said, I do think there is a place for him, and hopefully a place for Ian Clark as well, just because they stretch the floor a little bit. McCaw's a better defensive player. So I would ballpark it that I think he's going to get somewhere between 8 and 10 minutes per game, and then maybe you see that shrink as if the Warriors make it to the conference finals or the NBA finals, just because when you start to ratchet up Curry and Durant and Draymond to 40 a game, you just don't have that many left. And so they're going to have a wealth of options to look at that are all similar in quality. So it'll also depend on how much they play Draymond at center, because that opens up minutes for small guys, and how comfortable they are playing Zaza Pachulia, JaVale McGee, and players like that, because he's competing really, depending on the way that Kerr sees it, he's really competing with everyone in terms of that world. Another question from, I guess it's Swegan. Do you feel a moderate turnover percentage or rate is inherent in the Warriors/Kerr's motion offense? And they used David West and looked at it. And the answer there is yes. When you have a system that relies on ball movement and player movement to a degree, but more ball movement like the Warriors, there is a level of risk in every single thing you do. Because then the ball moves more times, there's just the option of not only random chance, like a bad bounce or something like that, but also just the chance of an opponent jumping the pass or anything like that. And one criticism that I have sometimes of the Warriors when they get, it's not when they get more complicated sometimes, but it's just the nature of some of their sets, is that they can get in these moments where there is only one pass to make and it is incredibly obvious. And that's not always a bad thing. If the guy's trailing behind the defender, if he's trailing behind, or if you run the right system, you can have an obvious pass that leads to an open three, that leads to a layup, that leads to a dunk. But at the same point, if you get into a system, especially in the playoffs where you face the same team over and over again, where the opponent can guess it and can get their hand there before it gets to the teammate, then you start getting pick sixes, you start getting transition points the other way, and the Warriors do have a few preventable turnovers that way, and that's also an argument for those of us who support running more basic stuff like a high pick and roll or something like that. While those plays can get predicted as well, sometimes getting a little bit more basic can actually lead to something that is, it's harder to deal with also because there are a lot of different angles on a pick and roll and you have other options depending on what happens with help. And if it's Stephen Curry running it, you have to send help or at least divert attention away from it. So that's something that you can do there. But sometimes when the Warriors are running their prettier sets, you get into those spots where it's really like kind of for quarterbacks, it's like if there's a one read pass. One read passes are sometimes very ambitious plays, but at the same point, there's a real risk involved because if that's not there, then the whole thing kind of falls apart. So if you have enough time on the shot clock, you can figure out something else. You can do a lot of different things, but sometimes they get trapped in those spots and it doesn't work. And then also sometimes they just throw more ambitious passes than they need to. And you could say that the offense facilitates that to a degree by empowering the players. And for the most part, I'm okay with that. I mean, that's a discussion that's been going on basically since I've covered the team, especially since Kerr's gotten there, that the idea of kind of oracle turnovers and the overly flashy passes. And it would be great if you could say, yeah, Stephen Curry in particular, Draymond actually does a lot of this too. If they could cut out the worst 5%, or let's say their worst two passes of every game, the Warriors would be much, much, much better off. But there is also an argument to be made that it's functionally impossible to allow players to be themselves and to be aggressive and assertive and having fun, enjoying the system, and make them feel self-conscious about that. And I don't know them on a personal level. I don't in terms of whether they can take that kind of coaching, and also if they do get it, how it affects the way that they play. So Yeah, that would be ideal, but I also understand why it doesn't happen. So to answer the basic question, yes, absolutely a moderate level of turnovers and probably higher than a lot of other systems. Teams that run a lot of isolation in particular do not turn the ball over very much, depending on the post-up team. The Charlotte Hornets, when they had Al Jefferson, never turned the ball over, and part of that was because the ball just wasn't moving. The Raptors almost never turned the ball over. So I would say that that's fair to say. A part of it is inherent to the system, and a part of it isn't bad, but ideally you could reduce the other stuff, and that amount that was the amount that's still left is totally tolerable, totally reasonable to work through. Question from Wicknest. Regardless of the outcome of this year's playoffs, how do you think the team will look for next season? What second round matchups could we see that will comfortably continue to rest Durant, if needed? Well, to answer the second part first, if it's needed, the Warriors are going to sit Durant. They don't have the urgency there, unless maybe it was the very end of a series, to risk a long-term injury, especially considering he's a free agent and he has no obligation to the Warriors after this year. So they're not going to push him into that spot. He might push himself, and then you can have a very different conversation. But I would say the most favorable situations that you can really get yourself into would be against a team maybe like Oklahoma City, where they don't have a ton of offensive engines, and so that means that they certainly can win. I mean, the Thunder are a talented team, but they can't push the Warriors into shootouts, and that I think would be what would most inspire the coaching staff to bring in Durant. And to answer the first part, in terms of how do I think the team is going to look for next year, it's a very open question. I've laid this out. If you haven't listened to it, listen to the full Locked On Warriors I did, I think it was about a month ago, about Durant's basic decision. And so basically the idea is he can either take, assuming he's going to do 1 year contract either way, which is not necessarily true, but probably true, he can either take about $4 million less, and then they can use what are called non-bird rights, and then they can keep their cap exception. So that means they could go over the cap and into the luxury tax to re-sign Livingston, to re-sign Iguodala, to re-sign Ian Clark, whoever else they want to go there. Or Durant can say, hey, I want all the money that I can possibly get. And then they have to use cap space because they don't have an exception big enough to fit him in because of the way salaries are rising and everything else. So in that case, then they have to clear it with cap space, which makes it much harder to retain Livingston and Iguodala. I am more positive than most that he will decide to take that sacrifice. I know it's a lot of money. $4 million is a lot of money to give up. The exact number's in there. I think it's like 4.5. But having really good teammates is important, and also it would only be for 1 year, because at that point the Warriors would then have early bird rights on him and could basically, because then you can give him a larger raise, and that would be enough to get him to his maximum. So they could kind of come to that wink wink nudge nudge understanding. That would also, if you want to take a 4 year contract at that point, it might connect him up with Stephen Curry, so they would both be free agents at the same time, which is definitely something I could see Durant being interested in. So if that's the case, I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Warriors basically brought the band back and gave some of the players, probably Livingston would be the most obvious, a shorter, more lucrative deal, because the Warriors are going to get really expensive with time, and those Livingston and Iguodala are at some point going to age out of being as useful as they are right now. So that would kind of hedge their bets. I also think in that circumstance, unless somebody makes a stupid offer to Ian Clark, he could definitely be back. I'm sure they would love to have him. And also Clark then would become an option in case Livingston left. If Durant makes the other decision, those guys are probably gone unless one of them wants to take a gargantuan pay cut, which is certainly possible, but not definite. I mean, we saw Manu Ginobili do something similar like that. Tim Duncan actually did too. And then they got more afterwards, but you don't expect that as a precedent. So that's a kind of a nasty hedge, but at the same point, it's the truth. I'm legitimately unsure on which way that's going to go. A related kind of question to the first part of that from, I think it's SLR Smegma. Which teams are bad first-round matchups for the Warriors? They're thinking bigs like Memphis and Denver, but what are the weaknesses that could drag the Warriors into extended games? I think the biggest thing you want to look at in terms of a potential weak spot for the Warriors in an early round, so those teams are going to be less competitive overall, is a team that has a lot of variance. So why I mentioned Oklahoma City in the first part was there is not that much variance, especially offensively with that team. I mean, if they're getting out in transition a lot, they're going that way. But remember back to that Denver game. So when the Warriors played them there, it was on the tail end of back-to-back, and Denver just couldn't miss a shot. Those are the kind of games that can push you into longer series because there's just not much you can do. So I would say the teams on that logic that you wouldn't want to play are probably Denver, the Clippers, if they fell down to the seventh seed, which I don't expect to see. Maybe Portland, but Portland's offense hasn't always been great against the Warriors. And then I would feel more comfortable against the Grizzlies and the Thunder because they don't really have that high ceiling. But Memphis has been a little bit more competitive recently. So I want to see that a little bit and really balance out how it's going to work. And remember that while Memphis has had success against the Warriors this year, the Warriors haven't really gone small that much. And they did have some trouble in that game at Oracle. So a lot of things worth watching. They're all pretty close. I'm going to do a full podcast on that once we have a better idea of who's in and who's out. I'll do a whole thing on ranking the Warriors' opponents of the likely playoff team. So that'll be fun. I've already planned on doing that the whole time. Another question from Swegan. They're listening to your most recent Real GM podcast with Arturo Galletti. You can check that out. It was Real GM Radio West Over Unders. You spoke about an interesting Spurs lineup featuring Kawhi at power forward to match up with the Spurs, or match up with the Warriors. To maximize both defensive and offensive versatility, would Mills, Green, Anderson, and Aldridge comprise the rest of the lineup? So for me, the best lineup that San Antonio could trot out against the Warriors, the mandatory pieces would be Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, Kawhi obviously being the frontliner, but Danny Green is important too, and LaMarcus Aldridge. So those three guys, LaMarcus is their best kind of offensive center. Kawhi is their best player. Danny Green is their second best perimeter defender, but also a great player to involve in basically any action, and he's really good on ball. In terms of the other two spots, there are a couple different ways that you can go with it. One guy that I think would work really well there, you'd take one spot and you either give it to Patty Mills or you give it to Manu Ginobili. The benefit of Ginobili is that if you're going to use Danny Green as the primary on Curry, then Ginobili's a little bit bigger and he can manage a lot of those. Also, he can switch a little bit more ably than Patty Mills, especially if you get into a circumstance where Durant is back. And one of the things that people like me liked so much about the idea of a Curry-Durant pick and roll is the idea that Durant can murder those switches. And so theoretically, if a bunch of things got garbled up, you'd rather have Manu on Durant than Patty Mills, because Patty Mills is just going to get torched. So that's one part of it. The other part is you could probably go with Jonathan Simmons. That's actually the way that I would probably do it. He's very athletic, had a great game, arguably the best game of his career was against the Warriors on opening night, but he's very athletic. He can be that like fifth offensive player, but he can also be active and switch and be just a pain in the Warriors side for that whole time. I would consider that. The other player who would loom large potentially is Dwayne Dedmon. Dedmon is a defensive anchor, can really stop any penetration that the Warriors have, and I think he's getting better when I watch him. He's getting better on switches, getting better on kind of pick and rolls, so he could work in well, but I still think LaMarcus at center, Kawhi at the four, and then some combination of those three guys on the perimeter is just a monstrous group. We haven't really seen Greg Popovich use it very much, but it's definitely interesting if he wanted to go in that direction. Mitch Shredder asked, what do you think is Ian Clark's future with the team going forward? And then basically, is he Steph's long-term backup, or where does he go with that? So Clark is going to be an unrestricted free agent this summer. What that means is the Warriors do not have any match rights. They don't have any special ability to retain him other than the fact that they will have a degree of bird rights on him. So depending on where the Warriors go in terms of the cap and depending on what he wants in terms of cost, they might be able to retain him with that. So the general rule that I always use with players like that is the Warriors will try to bring them back at a price that is reasonable, but if another team makes a crazy offer, then they're probably going to let him go. I think of Clark at this point, not really in terms of being Steph's backup or Klay's backup, but just being the amount of minutes that he'll deserve. And I would ballpark it in the regular season at somewhere like 10 to 15. And then the playoffs, you lower that down to 8 to 10 or something in that range. And that's a really valuable piece. So if Livingston left, I think you would want to have another point guard on top of it. You'd want somebody who's a little bit more stable in that, who can really make that their default position. So he would have the benefit there. And outside of it, you're going to have to ask him what he wants, because he has complete choice in the matter. So if another team offers him a more reliable role, maybe they have 20, 25 minutes a game, maybe they offer him a ton of money, can do that. And one of the big moving pieces for Ian Clark is going to be, how far do the Warriors go and how big a part of it is he? Because we've seen Warriors role players at other moments. I mean, even going back to Jarrett Jack, seen them just get overpaid because the team was successful and people always want those guys with championship DNA and everything in that realm. And so if the Warriors do win the title this year and Clark is a part of it, even if he's 8 to 10 minutes a game, somebody might make a mistake there. And the Warriors, knowing what their luxury tax bills are going to be in the very near future, would probably let him go. So that's where I'm leaning at the moment. I actually think his value could rise for the Warriors if Durant wants to maximize it, as I talked about before, because of the idea that they have early bird rights on him. So they could go up to, I think it's the estimated average player salary right in there. So that'd be about like $7 million a year. That would actually be, he would in many ways be their best case scenario for a backup point guard if Durant did that and Livingston is unwilling to take a massive pay cut. So, because his hold will be at the minimum because he's a minimum salary guy. So that would actually be a way of making that work. He could be a fallback in that case. So a lot of moving pieces with Clark. And it's hard if you're kind of a role player in the NBA because you are really at the mercy of what everybody else is asking for. And also, if you're getting a multi-year contract, you're at the mercy of what happens to the other team moving forward. I mean, we have tons of examples in NBA history of a player being on a team that really values them on the first year of that contract, and then they draft a guy or they sign somebody else to block them, and then by the time they're a free agent, they've been marginalized, they've been forgotten about, and then they're kind of looking for the next contract. So I'm sure Clark and his agent are going to be very cognizant of that, but sometimes there isn't a way to do it, and if somebody offers them ridiculous money, you take it. I mean, he hasn't made a ton of money in his career, so you absolutely have to do that. Two more quick questions. One from Wicknest. What do you think of the main reason for Stephen Clay's slump? It seemed to have started before Durant got hurt. I did a whole podcast on kind of where I saw the timing of it. I drew the line at that Denver game. I think that it was just kind of bad luck and a little bit of fatigue. Curry was missing more of his open shots than you usually see. Clay was just not really in rhythm, but the quality of the looks they were getting wasn't substantially different. And when you see a guy slumping, that is the most common thing, is that their source of shots has changed around. So if it's somebody who gets a lot of shots at the rim, which are usually higher value, all of a sudden they're not driving as much. They're not getting as many layups and dunks. That can be an easy way for a guy to look like he's slumping. That didn't happen with Stephen Clay. They were really getting their points in the same type of ways. It's just they were missing shots they normally make. So fatigue, changing the role, a little bit of stress, mental, physical, I think all that runs together. So that's really the best explanation that I have for it. And then the last question is from exasperated_dreams. And it's, what record will the Warriors end up with? How will they fare versus the Rockets and Spurs? Will they keep the one seed? So I've been thinking over the last little bit that my instinct is that the Warriors are going to lose three more games. I don't know exactly which three they're going to be. I think maybe two of them are in this four-game stretch between where they faced the Grizzlies and then the Rockets and then the Spurs and then the Rockets. I think they could lose two of those and then just one other game throughout the rest of the year. That's something the Warriors do sometimes. They just lose a game. So that would put them at 65 and 17 is probably good enough to win the West. That would mean that the Spurs could only lose one more time this year. I expect the Spurs will lose at least twice this year, even though they have some winnable games. They have a lot of winnable games on their schedule, and they're awfully good. Something I've noticed about the Spurs, particularly this year, but it was also true to a point last year, is that they are incredibly good, but they very often lose like one game in like an 8-game stretch by 2 or 3 points. That's just something that they do. Maybe Pop wants to rest their guys, so they put themselves at a little bit of a disadvantage. And if they do that twice, then that's probably enough for the Warriors to win the West and to get everything like that. I think that the Warriors will, my instinct is that they'll really struggle in one of the three games, the Spurs Rockets games. And for the life of me, I've been struggling to figure out which one it's going to be. I mean, the Spurs one is the most obvious because it's on the tail end of a back-to-back, and San Antonio is an awesome team, especially at home. But I could also see it being the Rockets just because they have fewer options to really figure everything out. And the Rockets will be able to use Trevor Ariza a little bit differently and put Harden on McCaw, put Harden on Matt Barnes. And if D'Antoni does that, which I fully expect him to do, that could be a problem in that game. So I'm very interested in it. But as I said, I think my guess right now is 65 and 17, and that is just enough to win the West, maybe by a game or so. And, you know, I think that would be a successful point for the Warriors if they can do it. And they're largely favorable end of the season is good for them, because that allows them to put heat on San Antonio, whatever really the Spurs end up doing. So I don't think Popovich cares also nearly as much as the Warriors do. And that wasn't a big part of the story last year, because the Warriors were just a little bit better, and they went 73-9. But it could be this year. And Popovich understands, as Kerr does as well, but he understands the value of just making sure that you start the playoffs at 100% and not going full bore. I think the Warriors are going to be better about that this year than last year, but just that difference in attitude about it might be enough to really make the difference. So that's enough for now. Again, thank you so much to the r/Warriors community for giving me the questions. I love doing it that way. And I'm going to do an email bag at some point, take Twitter questions, all that sort of stuff. But I really do appreciate it. And if you want to send any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com, at DannyLarue on Twitter. And as I said, I will be back on Friday night/Saturday morning for a podcast on the Kings game, and then Sunday night/Monday morning for a podcast on that Grizzlies game, which will be absolutely fascinating. And I don't know if we'll have guests. It'll just really depend on if the games are good and if I have somebody who says they want to do it. So it'll all run from there. And then if you want to support the show, leave a rating, leave a review in the podcast player of your choice. Also, subscribe, download every episode. And if for whatever reason you or somebody that you talk to, if you spread the word about the show, says that they can't access it or they can't find it on their player, let me know. That happens sometimes, where either a feed gets messed up or we just don't know that it should go somewhere, that it's not going. And just let me know and I will look into it. Again, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the best way to do that. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.